FBI Studios. This is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Roth. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Truth and Justice. This is your first Friday follow-up episode for Season 12, Episode 1, Up the Hill. In this first episode, we just got a little taste of the case that we're going to be covering this season on Truth and Justice, just some very basic facts of what happened on the night of September 17th, 2006. I'm joined today in the studio by Mr. Zach Weaver.
Hey, guys.
And remotely by the wonderful host of our follow-ups, Miss Janet Varney.
Hey, everybody. I am so excited. I'm sure you are as well about digging into season 12.
That's right. So after a quick break, we're going to get right into your questions.
Texas Ranger James Holland is a legendary interrogator. They call him the serial killer whisperer.
You can't hide those indications. And that's why yesterday I knew that he did it.
But now, shocking interrogation tapes reveal how the super cop really operates.
And that's why they asked me to come in, because I'm special.
From Something Else, The Marshall Project, and Sony Music Entertainment, this is Smokescreen. Just Say You're Sorry. Listen and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Ford Ranger, a vehicle for all terrains and every passion. It's a workmate, a playmate, and to its drivers, a soulmate. So how do you improve the Ford Ranger? You go all in. The all-new Ford Ranger, the UK's best-selling pickup. Now available with rear bumper steps, tailgate workbench, and enlarged load box that can fit a Euro pallet. Go break it in. Search all new Ford Ranger. Ford Pro. Driving productivity. According to SMMT data, features may be optional extras with additional cost.
All right. I know, Janet, on your outline, you had a couple housekeeping things. Zach, I told you to write one down. What was it?
Obsessed Fest.
That's right. So couple live show things coming up. So we still have some tickets available for the April 16th show in Grand Rapids, Michigan. That's with me and the captain and Kelly Brink from True Crime IRL.
Great.
I don't know how many tickets are left, but I know there's still a few. It's a big theater that holds like 400 people. But you should definitely check that out. You don't have to be in Michigan either. So Grand Rapids, for those of you who don't know where it's at, if you're in Chicago, it's only, what would that be, maybe 3 hours?
3 hours, probably.
From Indianapolis is maybe 4 hours. The captain's coming from Columbus, Ohio, so it's not very far. But yeah, we still got a few tickets left for that. I think the VIP section is sold out, but the regular seats are available there. And then Patrick from True Crime Obsessed reached out and wants me to come to Obsessed Fest, the first ever True Crime Obsessed weekend. It sounds like a fucking blast. It's going to be September 30th through October 1st or 2nd, something like that. It's in Columbus, Ohio. I will be there for that. I know Maggie's going to be there. Of course, Jillian and Patrick and Robbie Chowdhury is going to be there. I don't know who else is going to be there. Sounds like a super fun weekend. Lots of live shows. I don't know what exactly is going on. It says that there's going to be panels, but not the boring kind. Okay. Sounds like fun. There's going to be a karaoke contest, which Patrick has told me that I'm required to sing at, which will be upsetting for everyone.
I think. What song would you sing?
You know, I put a lot of thought on this. I've got – anybody who listens to True Crime Binge knows that my typical go-to karaoke song, if I get forced into it, is American Pie, for the simple reason that, number one, it's in a key, if that's a thing. I don't understand how music works.
I don't know either.
It's in a key that's easy to sing.
Okay.
And number two, you only have to get through the first verse.
And then everybody sings with you.
Right. And as soon as you get to the chorus, the entire bar will sing with you. Perfect. And so you don't have to sing
well
anymore.
Done.
So long
well
song,
done.
Though. Yeah. Long song. Bold choice
long,
in
it
how
goes
long
on
it is.
For a while.
Yeah. Yep. I just sang Lionel Richie's All Night Long on the cruise that I was on. And it okay. was
But you're felt probably right. like a trained singer, aren't you?
It's almost worse to do karaoke when you're a trained singer because you expect things to happen that don't because it's like a backing track. This is something I've researched. A lot of people who sing for a living hate karaoke, and I don't sing for a living, but it's a whole thing.
So the other thing I thought about doing that just feels like it would be fun for me to do, I don't know if I could pull it off though, is Elvis's Jailhouse Rock.
Oh, right. Sure. Like oh, it. That would I be like great. It. That's a great one.
Right.
Yes.
But is it a little on the nose?
Maybe. But it's a lot of fun. It's a short song. It was back when songs were like 2 minutes long.
Yeah.
So you know,
I like it. I'm into it.
Right.
It's on brand. It's not on the nose. It's on brand.
It's on brand.
Similar,
exactly
different.
Right. So Obsessfest. I think tickets are available now for Obsessfest, so check that out. Just look up. I don't know what the website is. Look it up. But this all just happened in like the last day. So we got the April 16th show, Grand Rapids. We got Obsessfest. Of course, we got Crime Con. You can still use code RUFF for Crime Con. That's coming up at the end of April. I think that's all I have for any live shows. There were some other. Did you have anything else written down for housekeeping stuff?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, I guess this, I don't know if this counts as housekeeping, but it's been really, really interesting and exciting to see what's happening in the Adnan Syed case. Also a little bit bittersweet, right? Because what's happened for Adnan is what we were all hoping would happen for the West Memphis 3 folks. You want to talk about that?
Yeah. So we've actually had some very positive news out of Adnan's case. So we have, what's happened is, I was talking to Robbie on the phone the other day. So essentially, she ended up hiring an attorney that works with the Innocence Project for Adnan, who happens to know Marilyn Mosby, the DA in Baltimore. And she was able to get Mosby to actually take a look at the case. Because, you know, we've had, you know, Thiru Vignaraja, whatever his name was, the asshat that was running that office for so long, that has been fighting tooth and nail against Adnan's exoneration. So he's gone, or he's not a part of this anymore. And now all of a sudden we have the DA's office working with us. So here's a great example of what could have happened with the West Memphis 3 case. Last week, I think it was Friday, a joint motion was filed for a ton of new DNA testing. And so a joint motion is what we were hoping for with the West Memphis 3 case, which means the defense and the prosecution came together and said, we both want to do, and it's a ton of testing. Stuff that's never been tested before. Hayes clothing, the rape kit. There's a bunch of stuff that was collected that was never tested. They went together to the judge and said, we want to test this stuff. And then what happened was, what should have happened in the West Memphis 3 case was literally the next business day, which was Monday of this week, or it might have been Tuesday. The judge saw that it's a joint order and just ordered the testing. So boom, huge. Just like that, one day. Bam. Adnan's case is getting a ton of new DNA testing done, and we're really hoping that that will finally track down, figure out exactly who killed Haymon Lee in 1999.
Do you know if they're moving forward with like MVAC, or how are they going to do it?
I don't know what method they're going to use. I think MVAC may be on the table.
Because I think if they could use MVAC, I mean, that helps push a lot forward for us in the West Memphis 3 as well.
Yeah. Conversely, on the West Memphis 3 case, of course, we had the motion which Cressman did not join, and then Cressman gave his ridiculous, asinine response to which Damien's team gave one of the best response motions or filings that I've ever seen, where they just ripped it to shreds. You guys heard it all. I broke it all down. And so in that case, the judge has ordered oral arguments in a hearing that's going to take place on June 23rd in Jonesboro, Arkansas. Zach and I have already committed. We're going.
We're going to be there.
And Damien has put out that he wants as many people there as possible. So mark your calendars, June 23rd. I see Janet's looking at a calendar right now.
I am looking at a calendar. I would love to come.
That'd be fun. We could finally meet in person.
I know.
Of all the time I've been in LA, somehow we've never met when I've been there.
I know.
But June 23rd. And I believe it's in Jonesboro, Arkansas. We'll have more details as it gets closer, but we want to have a big showing there for that hearing and a show of support for the West Memphis 3 to get this testing done. But this is the hearing that was avoided in Adnan's case because you had a district attorney that is actually searching for the truth along with the defense.
And didn't
so
she go
hats off to Marilyn Mosby? What's that?
Yeah, I was just going to say, didn't she go as far as to sort of say, whereas in some cases, as we've talked about on the podcast, the whole sort of evidence, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, where, you know, people are quick to say like, well, that doesn't mean anything. Didn't she actually say something that basically was like, and by the way, whether we find someone else's DNA on it or not, if Adnan's isn't on there, that is significant. Didn't she say something like that? That sort of already laid the groundwork for like, and by the way, please don't think that that's going to mean to me that, you know, that it changes nothing. I think it's significant if Adnan's DNA is not found on any of those items.
Right. Yeah.
It's huge, right?
From what Robbie has said, yeah, that basically that Mosby's looked at the case file enough to, I think, already has inklings towards the idea that Adnan may be innocent. And I think that what she's told the defense, from what I understand, is, yeah, that if they test all this stuff for DNA and a non's DNA is not found, that she would consider that actually evidence of absence, which is not always the case.
Yeah, more exonerating so kind of stuff. And I remember
it could be exonerating.
I just rewatched the case against Adnan Syed recently after Rabia's. There's a free Adnan support page on Patreon. I'm sure some of you are part of that as well. And she had given a little update, a very short update to people who support Adnan and are donating to his legal fund quite a few weeks ago, saying, I can't tell you what's going on, but this is going to be a really good year for Adnan. Like, really good stuff is happening. And so in anticipation of that, I went and listened to her book. I listened to Adnan's story for like the fourth time. I re-listened to a bunch of early episodes of Undisclosed, and I rewatched the case against Adnan Syed. And I remembered that, you know, there was that district attorney that was in that documentary who was so pro Adnan and was like, if I get elected in this election, this case goes away. He needs to be out of prison. And then Marilyn Mosby got elected instead. And everyone was really crestfallen, like, oh, she has not made the same kind of statements. So it's so encouraging that this is still going well for him, right. You know?
Yeah, I'm super excited about it. And Rabia told me she cannot, and it's not even me being coy, like, she told me, but I can't tell you. She won't tell me either. But when we were talking last week, she said that she really feels like he's going home this year.
Oh, it's so
great. She said she can't tell me.
That's amazing. That's really awesome.
She said she cannot tell me why, but the impression I got was that this DNA is just the tip of the iceberg, that there's a lot more going on there.
Maybe someday we'll find out what the bombshells are, Colin's bombshells are. We've been hearing about them for years.
Right. The bombshells from Colin. Well, and also I found out in Rabia's Instagram post the other day which I didn't know, was that just a couple of years ago, they offered Adnan a plea deal.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
They offered him, and I don't know if I missed it or if it was never shared before, but they offered him, it was like, four more years or something.
It's in the documentary, buddy.
Oh, is it? Wow.
It's in episode 4.
Part.
You get a pass. You've been working on a lot of other stuff. You get a serious pass on that. Real quick, JP, since we're talking about this, JP on YouTube asks, will you be live streaming or posting on the 23rd of June? Would love to follow the day's developments. Any plans?
For sure. We'll be doing, it's been so long. So at Adnan's last hearing, I was doing back in the days of Periscope, every time we had a break in the hearing. But now we'll probably be doing YouTube live. But yeah, we'll absolutely keep everybody informed of what's going on with that.
Very cool.
And with that being said, we've got a new case, a new season.
Sure,
what do you guys
do.
Think?
Oh, I'm so excited.
Man, I am excited. It's about time. First of all.
Okay. Wow. First, well,
I speak
all right,
for,
let's get the insults out of the
all
way.
All the listeners.
First.
No, I feel like I'm the voice of the listeners, right? So it's about time. But I know this is taking a lot of work, and I'm really excited to hear about this case. And I think you set the picture really well for us. You know, the community is really strange, but it also seems like the perfect place for a crime like this to be committed. I mean, there's the houses are far and few between. It's out in the desert. There's little to no response. If there's a response time, I mean, this community seems like if a crime like this is going to occur, this is the place for it to happen.
Yeah. Part of it is like, yeah, it's out in the middle of nowhere. It'd be easy to get away. But then the other part of it is you'd think that it would be difficult to like how many cars are on the road at 10 o'clock at night.
Sure.
And
it makes noise because it's a dirt road. And
right.
Well, this is always the hardest part. I'm sure that the many listeners share my sentiments, which is in some ways, these first couple of episodes are the hardest of the season because you raise so many questions. And these are such avid listeners and sleuths that everyone wants to ask questions that we know the answers are probably coming. But it's so hard not to want to get all of that information right away.
It's so hard for me to write because what I want to do is sit down and write a 4-hour episode and tell everybody everything, but it's not the way I've, number one, it's just, you know, we'd have one episode for the show. Not that it only takes 4 hours. It's going to take a lot longer than that. But you know, our methodology of studying these cases is to go point by point, but
sure.
I mean, even we're just going to go over victimology this week. And even that's going to get people's heads spinning. I guarantee you're going to lose your mind when you hear this week's episode. Also, I'll just kind of foreshadow a little bit for you guys. There were two people convicted of this crime, obviously, or we wouldn't be doing it. It's really difficult for me sometimes to figure out how to present the case. Do I go right into the case against them? Or do we break down our investigation and look and see, you know, what things look like? I've opted for the latter partially because this case was cold. The first arrest wasn't made in this case for 8 years.
Immediate red flag. Immediate red flag. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I don't know where this case is going. I don't know where anything's going in this case. But it doesn't seem like, you know, with the setup, it doesn't seem like there's any lack of suspects.
Right.
Everybody that lives up there could be a suspect. I mean, you heard from Carissa, the lady you interviewed.
Yeah.
And she talked about the strange people that live there. You know, some people just want to be away, but some people, I mean, the loincloth guy, the ex-cop or police officer that wore night vision goggles, the person that chased her on the quad. I mean, there's all these, like, it wasn't necessarily safe up there. You know, I mean, there was a lot going
on.
Well,
and we don't know anything about the victims. So, yeah, that's, you know, we don't even know what the motive would be.
Three victims. You got three sets of victimology there. The crime scene is super confusing, which we're going to get in. We're going to dig in. I'm sure a lot of these questions are about the crime scene, but obviously we're going to break it down in detail. I'm working with Jim. I was supposed to go walk the crime scene with Jim Clemente last month. He ended up getting COVID on that trip. Everybody got COVID on that trip. It was kind of a wasted trip, it turned out. But he's still, we're going to try to do it without actually physically being there, which shouldn't be a problem. So we're going to break down the crime scene. But yeah, there's just, it's like understanding the crime scene, understanding the medical evidence and understanding the victimology of everyone is, there's just a lot here.
One of the big things I got from Carissa was literally the idea of like, everybody up there was just supposed to mind their own business. And you said that with everything being fenced in.
Right.
Yeah.
And she talked about there being, you know, people growing weed up there or ex-meth dealers, you know. My first theory is like maybe those people weren't minding their own business, quote unquote, and got into something.
Right.
I mean, you know, we talked about victimology and say we're moving forward into victimology next week. So I don't know all the risk factors because we haven't heard it. But I mean, like a major risk factor to me right now is just the fact that they live there.
Where they live.
Right.
That's a great point. And I echo what a lot of these listeners and folks who've commented have said, which is you did do such a great job kind of setting the tone for the series, for this season. And I think, you know, many of us, whether or not, it sounds like both a very unique community, but a lot of us know a community like that, you know, near where we grew up or near where we live now. We sort of, many of us have our own version of that, like, oh, yep, I know that community in some way, shape or form. And so it's going to be really interesting to see as we meet perhaps more of the players in that community, how it's set apart and what could have happened. I mean, I can't even imagine who's in prison for this. I'm so fascinated already.
Well, you know, one of the things she said that struck me, and you alluded to it afterwards, but literally as she's talking to you, she says, oh yeah, the first murders.
Right.
I mean, it just seems like this is not unusual. And then you said afterwards there was murders, there was child abductions, there was assault, there was
UFOs.
There was assaults.
Kid UFOs. Disappeared. Kid disappeared. Like this is, you know, I guess this is a time to like, this you could see if anybody went on the website and looked at like the maps and stuff and the aerial photos.
Yeah.
Like it's desolate out there. There's a story of these two guys, like two brothers are out working on a chainsaw and their 4 year old's kind of running around out in the yard and they looked up and the kid's gone. Broad daylight. Search. Kid was to this day has never been found.
Wow.
Just disappeared in the middle of the day.
That's crazy.
No idea what happened. I mean there's a clown that lives up there.
Okay. That's now you're going too far. Don't get into a clown. That's too much for us.
So listen, I was going to mention this episode was just, it was so hard to kind of pick and choose how to lay this out, but yeah, everybody in the Coachella Valley knows about Harpo the clown who just goes from like every day wanders through restaurants. He's a silent clown who doesn't speak, which is why they call him a silent clown. But he goes around, people take pictures with him and stuff. He lives up there. He's one of the closest houses to the Murray's been up there for 30, 40 years, however long he's been up there. I've been told that he doesn't speak even when he's not dressed up. Like I talked to someone who hired him to come to like a birthday party and he wouldn't talk to them.
Very strange.
Yeah.
I should get an interview with him.
You know what? I emailed him through his website. I did email because I was like, well, I know you don't talk. But he never emailed me back.
Is Harpo the Marx brother who never talked? Is that why he's called that? Full disclosure, I don't know anything about the Marx Brothers, but that's a
that
wild
very well
guess.
Could be. I had an unconfirmed story.
Might be right
that you know because everybody's like heard stories about. So some of the stuff I got to be careful with because like I have an unconfirmed story that I was told that on the day of the murders that there was a woman walking naked down the street down Alpine Road, screaming and yelling that she was going to burn all you motherfuckers to the ground, which is a pretty big risk factor.
Yeah,
right? That seems like, but I don't know if that could sure not be true also.
Right. I have no idea if that's true or not. There's just so many rumors that have generated around. So kind of getting back to what I was saying before with kind of my approach is I think the best way to tackle this case is to start at the beginning, work through the basic steps that we always take, right? Looking through victimology and breaking down the crime scene and doing a profile and working out from there before we get to the people who were later convicted.
Yeah. Well, I would love to start that. I might go a little bit out of order on these questions. I hope that doesn't mean I accidentally skipped something. I probably should have made, I should have put them in a certain order. But just to start out with, because this is definitely something that came into my mind and Zap, I'm sure it came into yours as well. You know, as soon as we hear that a fire is the sort of major component of this case, I'm sure many of us, including Mike here who wrote in, thought about your background. I'm looking forward to a case where your personal expertise, Bob, he says, will come into play. Did this play a role in your choosing the case? And then a follow-up question to that is, have you stayed up to date with any changes in arson science? I mean, even just going up into the desert where everything is flammable, I live in LA and everything is always on fire. I wonder when you go into places like that, do you immediately sort of see it always through a firefighter's eyes first?
Definitely. And it did play a role in the fact that as I was starting to study the case a little bit and reading through like the arson investigators' reports from trial, I've said before, some people will call arson investigation junk science, and it can be. But what makes it a junk science is when overzealous arson investigators try to say that they can tell you something that they can't possibly tell you. It's common. It happens all the time. So I can look at a fire, most fires, and break it down, and we call it digging, because you literally pull all the rubble out and sift through it until you can get down to the bones of the structure and look at burn patterns and things. I can generally, in most cases, tell you where the fire started. We call it point of origin. So what is the point of origin? And then I can look for heat sources and, look at the electrical wiring and, there's evidence if there was a short or something like that. I can oftentimes then tell you what the cause, the class that I have taught in the fire science program at our local college was called cause and origin. What caused the fire and where did it start? What I can't tell you is who did it other than through like interview tactics or things, regular investigative steps. And timing is a big one. And what I saw, we're going to get into this in depth later. But one of the things that I saw with this is in order to make things work, the arson investigator was like, no, because of X, I know that this fire started at this time.
Right.
And it's complete bullshit. There are way too many unknowns. So if you say, well, we know that Tim Summerlee saw the fire in this stage at 9:45. That's a timestamp we know we have. And we know when the fire trucks got there at 10:12 that the house was fully engulfed in flames. So therefore, we can determine that the fire started at 9:38 or no later than this. The problem with that is how many windows were open? Was there a breeze? What was the draft like? Was there accelerants used? How much accelerants were used? How many points of origin do you have? If you have multiple ignition points, there's all these unknowns that can affect how a fire, what was the fuel load in the house? How many couches were there? What were the couches made out of? These are all things that affect how a fire grows. One of the very first red flags I saw was that we have an arson investigator telling you when that fire started, and that's bullshit.
Hmm. Great.
Do you think if Becky's body wasn't found outside where it was found in the wheelbarrow that they would have just maybe chalked it up to a tragic accident, tragic house fire? Like if she was found in the house with her mother and stepfather, mother and mother's boyfriend?
Yeah, his boyfriend. They weren't married, but essentially stepfather. I don't know because I don't really know the protocol. I've had many fires like this where people have died in them. I don't know that they've ever done x-rays. On them. So maybe they have, and I don't know because it's just not part of my job to know. But that's how that was determined that there were gunshot wounds is they did x-rays and they thought, well, we'll learn this when we do over medical evidence. But John had pellets from a shotgun in his body and Vicky had a slug from a 40 caliber pistol in her body. they found through the x-rays. I don't know if they would have done those x-rays if they had just showed up and the house had just burned.
Yeah, if Becky's body wasn't
right.
consumed.
Becky's
outside.
Body is what flagged this as a crime.
And yet she wasn't shot, right? I mean, you said that her cause of death was undetermined.
Right. Well, yeah, it's so, and again, we'll get into this, but yeah, she wasn't, we don't know that she wasn't shot. The problem is like a large part of her chest cavity had burned so badly that there was no, you know, there could have been a through and through shot.
Okay.
You know, that went through and they were unable to, if it didn't hit a rib or whatever, or through the abdomen, there are possibilities that they just were unable to determine how she died.
It seems like it's got to be such a tough call how many further steps you would take when there are deaths in a fire for the very reason that you've stated, which is that if it's known that people often set fires or that people can set fires to cover up crimes, when you have casualties, you'd sort of imagine that it would be a go-to every time to do x-rays just to make sure. But
right.
if it's happening often enough, maybe that's just not even always a consideration.
Yeah, so you know, the motives from arson we usually say are for fraud, for money, for revenge, or to cover up a crime. It's usually one of those. So yeah, if there's any suspicion at all that you're trying to cover up a crime, then I would imagine that you know x-raying the bodies would be a step. And again, that may have happened in every case that I've worked. I don't know because I've never been a part of that.
Gotcha. A lot of these comments and questions center around. Unsurprisingly, and I think we can jump to this in a second, the wheelbarrow, right? That did really stand out for a lot of people. Before we get into that, just a couple more questions about the fire arson kind of side of this. And you may or may not have the answers or maybe planning on talking about this. Rebecca asks, how long did it take for the fire trucks to arrive after the 9/11 call was placed or multiple calls? How much time were the neighbors on scene before the trucks got there? And how long would it take for a house to become fully engulfed in flames?
So the timing is for it to become fully engulfed in flames is there's a lot of unknown factors. There's no way to time that. As far as the response time, we're going to get into it in some very detailed timeline later. What's sticking in my head is that the fire trucks arrived at 10:12. So that's you're talking damn near 27 minutes, something like that. So the fire station, if you look at the map on the website. And you see where it says like Highway 74 is the paved road. So where Pinion comes out and hits Highway 74, if you were to hang a left, it's like a quarter mile down, if that, the fire station's right there.
Mm-hmm.
But and we're going to get into the fire captain's testimony for driving up there in a later episode. But they got stuck on the way. I told you the roads are so horrible.
Yeah.
They, on the way up there, they turned and got stuck in some sand and had to back out and pull out. It was that's important. Me laying out that part of the scene is important to understand when we get into the actual suspects that were arrested and how they got away and what they were driving and all that. I mean, because the roads, even the parts that aren't washed out, it's like hard dirt road and there'll be a jagged rock that sticks up
sure.
5 inches out of the road. Like it'll just rip your oil pan off if you drove through with like a car that's lowered down.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fire trucks getting stuck is just another example of that, that it's just the roads were just terrible and unpredictable.
Another question about the fire itself. Megan asks, was an accelerant used?
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we're going to get into the arson investigation report. But yeah, there were. So on the website, and there's a diagram of the house in there. And that was actually drawn by Becky's father, Ron, who actually built the house himself way back. You know, he used to live in there anymore, obviously. But you'll see there's like red circles.
Mm-hmm,
those
yeah,
red circles,
I believe
that's where they found that there was accelerant, where the red
okay.
circles are on that map.
Gotcha. So let's shift into, there's some kind of big picture questions, but maybe it would be good to go out with those. Let's shift into the many wheelbarrow questions. Patty says, and there are some similar questions here. Patty says, I gather from the answers he gave, the man that witnessed the body in the wheelbarrow lived at the southeast side of San Carlo Road. Did he have a clear view? I think you said he did.
He did. Yeah, he actually did live in the southeast side of that road. And again, you can go to the website, look at the map. But so there, it's, I don't know the distance. It's probably 300 or 400 yards away. But where the back of the property where Alpine Road is, where the crime scene is kind of at the top of the hill. The entire neighborhood slopes down to Highway 74. So from his front bedroom, and he took me into his bedroom and showed me, you could look out and see up that hill. So when the house was standing, he would have been able to just see probably the top third of the second story of that house looking up the hill. And okay. The flames were coming out of the peak. So it was at the very top. He was able to look out and just see those flames coming out.
That's actually really helpful, because even though you took great care to describe that it's considered going up the hill, I don't know if I'm the only one, but I sort of imagine the community itself being uphill from the valley, but it being kind of flat. Because when I think of desert and I think of those kinds of communities that I'm familiar with, it's sometimes those are sort of on a plateau. And so it's actually right. really good to imagine that when he's looking out to that house, he's actually still looking uphill. That's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's a gradual slope in the neighborhood. It is kind of a plateau compared to the mountain road to get up to it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's definitely the elevation goes up as you move to the back of the neighborhood.
Well, and it becomes a little more easy. Like you said, it's so private. If there's a different, mm-hmm. if there's a difference in heights in the landscaping, then sometimes it is easier to see or not see based on like, well, it's a little right. up the hill, so I actually could see that, you know. Okay, great. Marie says, I'm confused where the neighbor was standing when he saw the body in the wheelbarrow. He said he was at the garage looking at the open door into the house where he saw the body in the wheelbarrow. Looking at the drawings and case notes, how was it possible he saw the body from where he was standing? He also says the stairs were on his right. I love that she ended it with, maybe I need to listen to this again. That section, I listened to this episode three times, and you kind of do need to really sit with that description and really try to picture it and look at those notes, because there's a lot of information coming there, right?
Yeah.
Do you want to
address that? Yeah. It's much easier if you look at it with the diagram of the scene. So he and I, after we were done doing the interview, he actually rode up to the crime scene with me, and we went out there and stood out there to see where he was at. And if you're looking at the diagram, so you see there's like the Ford Bronco that's on the little concrete patio spot in front of the garage that's off to the right. The garage door, as you're facing the garage, would be on your left. There's only a single garage door on your left if you're looking at the garage. So he was standing back in the driveway looking into – so he's probably still 30, 40 feet away from the house or the garage, looking through the open garage door. And then in the back of the garage is the open house door. Now, he said he saw stairs, but I believe what he actually saw were there were stairs going up to that door.
I see.
Okay. I think that's what it – because I don't think you could actually see the stairs
deeper into the house from there. Yeah, mm-hmm. That seems
– yeah, there's. I think based on the drawings, there was a wall there. He's standing out on the driveway, you know, straight out from the garage. And then if he turned to his right, which would be further to the north, northwest a little bit, it was up there is where the wheelbarrow was.
But, you know, looking at the diagram, it looks like if you came straight up the driveway, coming up the driveway, uh-huh. you're looking directly in the direction
of Becky,
where the wheelbarrow was.
Yeah. And their diagrams, and the one I have on it on our board out here, from the actual aerial photos and from being out there, I drew it a little. So they drew the driveway as kind of going straight up, but it actually, from Alpine Road, the driveway is offset a little more to the right, and it kind of curves up to the left, up into the house. So it kind of wouldn't be in your view, and there's cars in the way. But where he was standing, there was like this perfect spot between cars and pine trees where there was a clear view directly to where Becky's body was in the wheelbarrow.
And it does seem like if it's at night and there's nothing else out there, if there's something out at the corner of your eye that's light, you're right. going to turn and look at it.
Yeah. Right. And we had a long talk about that because he was, you know, he said he doesn't remember there being flames.
Mm-hmm.
But then we kind of together determined that the body obviously had to be. We know the firefighters had to extinguish her body.
Okay.
So it was on fire. And this is pretty awful, but just for you to understand, I mean, this is what we got to do. There, when a body is burning, especially in something like a wheelbarrow that's going to contain the body, you've got a couple of phases. It's assumed that they poured some accelerant on the body and lit it on fire. So you have the initial burst of the flame from the accelerant that then catches clothes on fire. There's some sustained burning from the accelerant that's in the barrel. And then there's a second, the fire might start to die down, but the fat on your body actually renders, so to speak, and becomes like an oil. And then, you know, and since it's in a wheelbarrow that's catching that, your fat on your body is very flammable. So it could be that the fire was died down, and then as more and more of that process had happened, that the flames picked back up again. But we kind of determined that because we looked at it, there's no way there was any light. Remember, it's pitch dark. There's no moon. The sun's way down. There's no exterior lights. And where she was at way back there, there was trees between the house and her. There's the only way he could have seen her is if there was flames coming from the wheelbarrow.
It's so eerie and horrible. You really described it. You said it's like something out of a nightmare.
Right.
I'm really glad that you, and Zap, maybe you agree. I'm really glad that you just set that out and set that straight, because I was wondering, was someone trying to get her out of the fire and it was too late? Like, in my mind, I wasn't clear that those are two separate fires. The intentional fire in the wheelbarrow and the intentional fire in the house. I didn't know whether or not it could be that, you know, one led to the other or someone was trying to get her away. I didn't know. So that's really important to know and imagine. Unfortunately, it's awful.
It gets even more perplexing because, and again, when we get into the crime scene, we'll break down all these details, but the wheelbarrow is pointing towards the house.
This is Daniel's This is Daniel's question. Yeah. He wanted to know, where is it facing? Is it? Yeah.
Yeah. So it's the handles of the wheelbarrow are facing north towards the national forest, or towards the desert. And her legs are hanging off that side towards the handle side. And then her body's in it. And then her head kind of goes up to the front, the end you would like tip over, which is towards the house. And there's some other weird things. One of the reasons I wanted Jim to go to the crime scene is it's downhill. Right? I told you the whole neighborhood gradually slopes down. So if the wheel is the wheelbarrow a red herring, right? Was the wheelbarrow just there and then her body was put in it to light her on fire? Or was her body being moved? Well, it certainly wasn't being moved away from the house in the wheelbarrow because it's backwards.
Yeah.
Unless they twisted and turned it around. But and if it was coming from, say, out of the desert or something, if they're going toward, like, if you brought her that far, why wouldn't you just continue into the house, which is downhill, which would be the easier part of that path? There's a lot to unpack.
Is there any question of whether or not that would have happened, but the neighbors got there too quick? Like, it sounds like it would just be impossible to get away fast. Like, to know someone's coming and to not be seen leaving seems impossible. To be stopped short from that action seems kind of impossible.
And there's some weirdness there, too. I'm trying to say how much I should break down now or later. But
I know. This is called episode one of a new season. It's happening.
Well, because there's so many mind-numbing mysteries here. So I guess because I was going to put it in the first episode, but I didn't want to confuse anybody and add more to it. We heard Tim describe that he looked through the open garage door. In the crime scene photos, the garage door is down, and the firefighters had to cut it open.
What?
Hmm.
What? Yeah. That's such a specific detail. You're saying you can see into the door of the house. What?
And that was the main reason I took him up to the crime scene, because all it's there is a concrete foundation now. And I told him, because he's like, I'm certain of it. I am certain. I looked into the garage, through another open door into the house, and there were stairs and stuff. And then when I knew that he had actually seen it, because he had no way of knowing this, so the foundation is like flush with the ground, the concrete foundation.
Yeah.
And he stood there. He goes, maybe I'm wrong. He said, because in my mind's eye, the door wasn't down on the ground. The door was up. He's like, it was like up 3 feet. It was up higher. And I see that the foundation's down there. So maybe I am wrong.
But that would allude to the stairs you talked about in the garage.
But then when I go back and look at the crime scene photos, the floor was built up 3 feet off the foundation.
Right.
And it was up higher where he saw it.
Well,
so now how'd the garage door get down?
I assume you've read transcripts of his previous interviews, because he did refer several times in a very responsible way to, this is what my memory is telling me now, but I was interviewed much closer to the crime. Perhaps I said something different then. Are there discrepancies there? Have you had a chance to review that stuff?
Yeah, I have. And no, he's very
clear about it then.
Yeah. Wow. He was very, because it was a thing then, because his wife, they later in that night, him and his wife walked up and talked to the firefighters and the door was down. And he said, and his wife and he had a conversation where she's like, I thought you said the door, garage door was open. He said, it was. She said, it's down now. And it's been this, like, ever since then, it's been this, like, what the hell? And so then there's been theories, of course, well, maybe the murderers, you know, were still there and they left. Yeah. But think about where they're at. How? How could you have a dirt road with one way in, one way out of the property, with now a bunch of neighbors standing out on the dirt road?
Yeah. And you had You had to know that was going to happen. There's no other light to see, really, except for the thing you've just created.
Right. And then, and so now there are times I've been to fires where the fire will call, like with the springs and cables and stuff on a garage door, where the fire will burn those and then they'll snap and the door will come down. Mm. Actually, I have a good friend of mine that almost died in a fire because he went in through a garage to fight the fire. And it got bad when he tried to back out. The fire had burned through and the garage door shut behind him and he got trapped. But this was one of the old fashioned tilty type doors, you know, that doesn't go up roll on a track. It's like a solid door that tips, but then you got and there wasn't much fire in the garage. So there's some experimenting and stuff that has to be done with this later for me to figure that out, the whole garage door thing.
How fascinating.
But we'll move on. I probably told you more about them. I'm adding too much information.
I guarantee you everyone wanted every bit of information that you just gave. I guarantee it. I would set my savings on it. Now, you don't know how much savings I have. It's not very much. Okay. Christina, this goes back a little bit to the sort of accelerant question, the timing question. Just want to shout her out here because she does ask, is there any way for an arson investigator to determine if the fire in the house was started before or after the fire in the wheelbarrow?
Yeah, and the answer to that is no, but that didn't stop them from doing so, which is one of the things that drew me to the case.
Gotcha. Catherine sort of says what I think a lot of us were thinking. Again, just going back to the perplexing element of the wheelbarrow, the two separate kind of crime scenes, so to speak. It's just so odd, she says, to just put her in the wheelbarrow and leave her out in the open while at the same time trying to torch the house. I'm curious to hear about the daughter's personal timeline for the day to see if it fits that she came home while the murderers perhaps were in process of torching the house. Maybe that's it. And that actually feeds into questions about the victim's families. Pamela asks, have you reached out to or spoken with the victim's families yet? I'm going to assume they believe authorities have the right people, feeling like this will be a tough case without their support and or cooperation.
Well, it'll be like every case. You know, very infrequently do we have the victim's family that want to participate in anything like this. I haven't spoke. So I've been out to John Hayward's son's house and was denied entry by him into his gated community. I've talked to some friends of Becky's who know the family. One did an interview with me and suggested I talk to, you know, it was kind of a breadcrumb thing. Well, you need to talk to this person who was best friends with her. Talk to that person, and she's like, if the family's not doing it, I'm not doing it, and the family doesn't want. So my understanding is that the family believes that they got the right people, which is not uncommon at all, and are not open to discussing it all. I have reached out in one way or another to everyone as best I know how. I haven't been able to find phone numbers for them. They don't all live locally, but I've like sent emails to email addresses that I think are correct and just haven't heard. So I don't know if they've received them or not, but I'm going to continue to try to do that. But I would not expect to hear from any of the family in this one. I think that they're pretty certain they got the right people.
Understood.
Back to the other one you did, the time. So we're really going to dig into Becky's timeline in this Sunday's episode.
So, I mean, I mentioned this before, not really knowing where the story goes, but I think that's going to be a big part for us, is to try to figure out who was the intended victim,
mm-hmm.
or was it just happenstance? If it's somebody in the house, then yeah, very possibly, like the listener said, Becky could have came home during the commission of the crime.
Mm-hmm.
But if it was Becky, then where did the other, you know, I mean, there's a lot. I think we really need to dig in and try to figure out who is the intended victim, or was it just happenstance that someone came, the crazy woman walking down the middle of the street that's going to burn everybody down, you know,
right.
where is it going?
Victimology,
in this case, I think that we're going to I'm going to double down on profiling the scene. I've told Jim, I'm like, I've never been more baffled. I've been to this scene 15 times, and there's been, you know, when I've been out there were days where I just drove out there, and it's a long drive. It's a pain in the ass to get there because I just I'm just walk. A lot of times for me, if I can walk in the steps of the killer, I can see, you know, I've talked about a lot of times, like in Haman Lee's case, like where her body was buried. Makes no sense on a map. But when I physically drove that route, I'm like, oh, that's why. Because I'm picturing this big national park or something, but Leakin Park was not, it was just a road that went through the woods. And it was like, oh, there's houses, there's lights, and you turn this one corner and there's the first place where there's nobody around, there's no lights, and there's a little spot to turn off. I can see why they picked this spot now. I've tried doing that over and over and over again with this case. And I went up there one night at 11 o'clock at night in the pitch black because I just wanted to be in the dark and kind of feel and see, like, is it reasonable to think anybody would be back in the desert? It's way too dark for that. Yeah. So, I told Jim, I was like, I've never needed a good profile on a case like this more so. Than this one, because it's those questions, like you're saying, Zach, are exactly what we need to know, because it's very important for us to try to figure out who was the intended target. I'll tell you, the police made an assumption, which led to their arrest. I don't know if they were right or wrong about that, but you know, I think the police really assumed, well, Becky's body is out on display, so they must have been after her, and the rest is collateral damage. I don't necessarily think that's the case, but I'm going to reach out to Jim, and then a mutual friend of ours, Janet, I thought about reaching out to Dr. Shiloh or Dr. Scott to see if they wanted to take a look also.
I'm going out there if that happens. Because, side note, and this absolutely should not be in the episode, but 15 times is a lot of times for me not to have seen you at all. Okay. Right.
I tried to have dinner with you the last time I was there, and you were out of town.
That was one time. Okay. Brian, I want to give also a shout out to our YouTube friends, because way before you even said anything about the garage door and the springs and burning, they were all over that. So there were many of you. Shout out to you, because I just glanced down after you had said that and said, oh, they were all saying that before even the expert weighed in. Okay, good to know. These are very smart people. No surprise there.
So real quick.
Yes.
Real quick on that. The interesting part about the, because I thought, like I said, I've seen it happen before. Not with that type of door, but I think it's possible. I need to look and see how the mechanics work. But there wasn't much fire in the garage. So I need to really do a good analysis of where the heat transfer would have been if that door was open, if there would be enough heat. With the open door to the house, it's possible that the main body of fire would be in the house, but there would still be enough radiant heat coming into the high, you know, the springs are at the top. The high part of the garage to cause some expansion and cause that to happen. But yeah, we're definitely going to be digging more into the garage door.
Okay, so we'll find out more about whether it was automatic or manual, like Pamela Westby asked, all that kind of stuff. Great. Just going a little bit again into victimology, Brian says maybe jumping ahead, hard not to with the first episode, agreed. But do you think Becky was the target, and was this revenge over something? I'm only thinking that because the killers took the time to separate her and put her in the wheelbarrow outside in the back. Or perhaps, as many of our YouTube friends have said as well, just in this chat, could it be possible she tried to get away, was caught in the back of the house? Is it, JP said early in the chat, is it a red herring? Is that wheelbarrow a red herring? I can't wait to dig into that more, because it is a huge question mark for us.
Yeah, and I don't have an answer for you. I have an opinion, but I'm not even going to share my opinion until we get into the real breakdown of the crime scene and the profile, because, yeah, it's huge. I mean, think of the pool of suspects we're looking for. If we're looking for someone who targeted John and Vicky, or if we're looking for someone who targeted Becky.
Yeah.
It's a completely different pool of suspects.
Speaking of that, and again, I'm sure this will be a huge part in future episodes, but got to address Rebecca's question. I think a lot of people were thinking this probably as well. Becky's body being found in the pose of supplication, as you were saying in your conversation with Tim. Rebecca uses the term the pugilist pose. Do you always see that? Does it only happen when someone is alive when the fire starts? What's going on there? Because you knew exactly what he meant. Was he gesturing?
Right.
Like, I had to look at the photo and go, it is what I thought was being described, but that seems very strange.
Yeah, no, it's very common. So the pugilist, okay. Pugilist pose, or what we call the boxer's pose, and it does no effect whether the person was dead or alive. What's happening is, as a body burns, and again, it's more kind of gory detail, but as a body burns, the tendons the body become, they start to dry out. And when they dry out, they shrink.
Okay.
And so what happens is For those of you on YouTube, you can see me with my arms. If you died, say, and your arm is out like this, as it continued to burn, in the tendons in your forearms and biceps and hands, fingers all start to dry out, your arms get drawn up like this. And so, yeah, every body I found that's been severely burned in a fire, they're always in this position.
Okay.
With their, you know, the kind of, so that I guess trying to describe it would be, you know, with your, I guess, arms at kind of right angles, your elbows tucked into your ribs, and then bent up at right angles with your hands kind of, just imagine if every tendon in your arms were contracted. That's what it looks like.
I'm glad that you clarified that, because in the picture, it's kind of hard to see exactly where the arms are. And it's very, as you've done, tastefully redacted. But when I hear supplication, I think the palms are together. Like when I hear supplication, I think someone is begging for their life. Like it was a very dramatic word to use. So I'm very glad that you clarified that, because what seemed strange to me was the idea of like somehow hands being in supplication. That's different.
And to be fair, I didn't really know what he meant when he said supplication. I just, as
you
soon
just
as he said it,
I know exactly what you mean.
I know exactly what. Okay. And then I had gestured. I'm like this. And
he was
like,
yeah, I like see. That. Okay.
Like, yeah.
Got it. Widening out a little bit, of course, the question of why you were drawn to this case above and beyond the fire element, Lynn wants to know, what wrongful conviction red flags alerted you to take on this case? You've mentioned the arson investigator having strong opinions when maybe they shouldn't, and the victimology of the police addressing a suspect right away. Were there anything else? Was there anything else that really stood out to you?
There's so much. I mean, we're going to get into all of it, but yeah, I mean, the arson investigation thing, I already told you this was an 8-year cold case. There was an arrest, charges were dropped, then a rearrest 2 years after that. Got, you know, witnesses that just come out of nowhere with crazy stories later down the road. None of the evidence really make it. There's some forensic testing that, you know, imagine forensic testing where multiple labs, including the FBI, test a piece of evidence and says there's nothing usable here. And then years later, another private lab comes in and says, oh, actually, there's a perfect fingerprint on that, or a perfect profile on. There's some of that going on.
Sure.
It's also was very clear that the detective seemed to have had blinders on right away. And that doesn't necessarily mean they got it wrong, but they definitely jumped to some conclusions early. And then there's a whole nother ball of wax when it comes to conspiracies, when it comes to some people who maybe should have been suspects, who, because of who they knew, ended up not being suspects. Or there's, we're going to get into all that. But I mean, there's, this case is an absolute disaster, the way that it was investigated and prosecuted. I'll say that.
Well, that leads to just a couple of last kind of questions and comments that I'm sure you'll be getting into deeper into the season. You know, Lori points out if getting to Pinyon Pines is rather difficult and it's that quiet a community, how were the perps able to flee? There's some chatter in the YouTube chat about how much it was likely that they would need to be local, right, to do something like this and then not be seen. And I think Nancy sums it up really well, too. How did this town end up as a place for people who wanted to live away from others so much? How do the people end up there? I feel like the town itself has a story. So hoping that you're going to grow out the community to help us to understand more about how this all happened and why people are in prison who are.
Honestly, the town could be its own podcast. And so I don't know how much we'll get into about, I don't know exactly right now where it all started. I'm super interested in it myself, but I've tried not to distract myself with a lot of the insanity that has gone on around there.
Is there any businesses in that region?
No.
Like where that community is?
There's, so when you go down to 74, there is the fire station. Then around the corner a little bit, there's like an old little diner. Okay. I don't even know if it's still operating, but there's a phone booth that's been decommissioned there. But there was no cell service up in Pinyon Pines. So a lot of people.
2006.
Yeah, would use. I mean, even now I can, like, because Jim asked me, he's like, well, I can go to the crime scene and FaceTime you. I'm like, no, you can't. You're like, maybe a phone call. Definitely not a FaceTime from up there. There's hardly any service, but people would, you know, if they were out driving, whatever, they would stop and use the pay phone there. But yeah, I'm trying to remember what else. What else was she asking about besides? Are there?
I kind of put them all into one section because I think it's just a sort of general idea of would the perps have to be local because of the community,
the way
it's shaped, the people keeping to themselves. Like, it's just sort of a big picture, you know, talking about the town and how big a part it may have played, or the community, rather.
I don't think that the police really considered the idea of them being local. It's something that I think we need to look at, and I don't know exactly where we're going to go with all that.
And just to know what area the police serve, you know, if that's such a small community, like, just to get a broader.
So it's Riverside County, and they don't have a station anywhere close to there. So they were long response time to get out there. But like I said, you can look at the map, and there are a few routes that someone could take leaving. You know, like if they turned left out of the driveway, there's two different roads they could take to head back south. If they turn right, it's kind of the same two or three roads. They all end up kind of funneling back down into the same place. But they have to drive down Alpine Road one way or the other. There's no reason to be on that road. And again, at 10 o'clock at night, as Chris, I don't remember if I included this in the episode. I think I did, Chris. You know, this is a very working class community. You know, people are, you know, at that time of night, it's quiet up there. It's people are sleeping. They're in bed. You know, people aren't staying up late at night. So you think at 10 o'clock at night on a Sunday night, people would notice a vehicle leaving the neighborhood. There is something coming up that involves a vehicle that we're going to be talking about in the next couple of episodes.
Well, you have absolutely roped everyone in. Everyone watching and listening right now are talking about how hooked they are already. I'm sure that's how all the listeners are feeling. Zap, you feel the same way, I'm sure.
Oh, where's this going? I'm ready to go. You know, we've talked about it before, but I'm so ready to get back to what Truth and Justice is and to delve into this. And I'm really excited to see where this case goes.
Yeah. I think that's all we've got.
Me too.
And we're glad that you too are excited about it. That would be really bad if you weren't excited about it. It would be very disappointing. So
I've been excited about this case for months, just waiting for the chance to start. And then, you know, part of it was, you know, people were asking about the family. So that was part of why I was kind of pushing back. I was hoping to make some more connections there, but it's, you know, we got to a point where it was like, we just need to start going. That they may be mad, but oftentimes that's how they'll reach out to me, because if I can't find them, I'm easier to find than they are. So, but yeah, make sure you tune in on Sunday we're going to break down some victimology. We're going to get into some timeline stuff. Tons and tons and tons more to come. Make sure you stay tuned. Everybody that joined us on the YouTube live, thank you so much. Sorry we didn't get to a lot of your chats, but we had a ton of questions.
I tried to summarize as much as I could.
Yep. So thank you, everyone. And make sure you tune in on Sunday. Thanks, Janet and Zach. And we'll talk to you guys all next week.
Thanks, everybody.
NBI Studios production and is distributed by Wondery. Edited by Mike Bussing, and all music for the show is created and composed by PutThemInASong.com. Our follow-up logo was created by me, and all of our fonts across all of our logos and banners were created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. You can find more of Tate's work on Etsy. Thank you to Katie Ross of CreatedInTandem.com for designing, creating, managing, and maintaining our website, TruthAndJusticePod.com, where you can view all photos and documents discussed in every episode. And a big thank you to our transcription team, Pamela Westby, Kathy McElhaney, Kaywood Yomnick, Ginger Fiola, Erica Cantor, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Ford, Courtney Wimberly, and Melissa Cardenas. And as always, thank you to all of you for all of your engagement and support. If you like the show and you'd like to support us, you can do so in several ways. To financially support the show, the best thing you can do is just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You'll not only be supporting the show, but you'll get something in return. On Patreon, you can pledge as little as $3 a month, and we have reward levels. For just $5 a month, you get access to ad-free versions of all of our episodes and behind-the-scenes bonus video content every week. Then other reward levels include t-shirts, hats, and even the opportunity to co-host one of our Friday follow-up episodes. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice. You can also do us a huge favor by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. And lastly, you can always support us by supporting the brands that sponsor this program. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider for future seasons, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. And the most important thing that you can do is to engage in our investigations. You can keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the Truth and Justice Podcast fans page on Facebook. And for all you tweeters out there, you can connect with us on Twitter at Truth Justice Pod. Follow our personal accounts on social media. I can be found in all forms at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney. And Zach is at Z to the Q. And don't forget that we always have our 24/7 voicemail line open for questions, comments, or tips on our cases. That phone number is 269-224-2833. However you do it, stay engaged, stay in touch. As for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice. I am joined by Zach and Janet. We are all three in.
You failed miserably.
What was I even thinking about saying? I don't even.
Wait, are we supposed to be streaming on YouTube? Right. Sorry, just checking. Not yet. Okay, got it. Sorry. Great. Yep. Sorry.